Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Snakes on the Diamond podcast. I'm your podcast host, Mike McDermott. I write for Fan Nation's Inside the Diamondbacks, covering the Arizona Diamondbacks from the Dominican League all the way to the Major Leagues. And for today's episode, we're going to have Wes come in to talk about the Yankee series. We're going to talk about some of the big stories from the Yankee series, the Perdomo injury, Zach Gallen, and the at-bat where the D-backs had to send up a relief pitcher with the series on the line, the starting rotation, as well as other topics from that series. And then in the second half of the show, we're going to talk with Braves Today publisher Lindsey Crosby to discuss the Atlanta Braves and kind of preview that series in a question and answer, which we'll be able to read on Inside the Diamondbacks. So for the first part of the show today, we're going to have Wes come on in. All right. So how are you doing today, Wes?
Well, I mean, I could be better. I'm all right. You know, so, like that was a terrible ending to a series that looked like it could turn out like actually all right. That's kind of is a bummer. It's kind of how I look at it.
I mean, when you look at this series, it was a pretty good series overall. Both teams kind of had a very easy win in the first two games. The third series turned into a pitcher's duel that kind of went into a back seesaw game in extra innings. It was exciting all the way to the end. So if you didn't have a vested rooting interest in either team, it was pretty good baseball all around, would you say?
Yeah, I mean, Diamondbacks, I mean, yes and no. I mean, yes, it was absolutely game three was a competitive game all around. I mean, it went back and forth. I'm really not a fan of the automatic runner at second, but it's a whole different conversation. Game two, excellent bounce back start from game one, Zach Gallen after a loss. I mean, it could have gone a little better. I mean, the bullpen, there are moments that bad base running, I think, not always fun to see. Like I said, I think the automatic runner is not good baseball to watch.
It depends on who you ask, but
yeah, it's so, I mean, if a traditionalist versus the progressive argument in baseball is a very I don't know how accepted it is now, but I'm not a fan.
So, yeah, the main argument for the automatic runner is to try and shorten up games and extra innings and avoid the war of attrition, which unfortunately happened in the final game of the series against the Yankees for the Diamondbacks. But let's start with Zach Gallen. Do you think yesterday was a step in the right direction or the unofficial return of Cy Gallen? As we're going to call
it. It's just like a step in the right direction. I think he's absolutely motivated to get Cy Young. This is a contract. He's a free agent for next year or this year?
He's under contract. He's under control through the 2025 season.
Okay. So, I mean, he's got two more seasons with the Diamondbacks. I know that one of his goals is to win a Cy Young before he hits free agency. He wants the bag. That's the bottom line with him. Like, I know that's a lot of his motivation is to be, you know, the best pitcher. I think he could do it. It's really, he didn't look great in the first start. He looked a lot better in his second start. I think it's like a promising step in the right direction. It looked a little livelier. It wasn't any mistakes. I mean, he shut down the Yankees lineup.
Yeah, because look at the starts. Obviously, Gallen walked three, but two of those three walks came in the first three hitters. He was kind of shaky in that first inning, but then the Yankees hit two ground balls, one of them being a double play. So two ground balls to second base. And it seemed to just be like the point for Gallen. It just took off from there. And the one thing, and I was charting this for the game, I was charting his movement numbers that show up on the left field video board. So I was copying down, and this is kind of, if for people don't know, more if the ideal fastball shape is a pitch that has just movement in this direction and less movement in this direction.
Less vertical, more horizontal.
No, you have it backwards. For a four-seam fastball.
More vertical, less horizontal.
So the thing I noticed with Gallen, and I only charted through the fourth inning because something else took my attention, and I was about five pitches behind, so I just said screw it. The amount of rise, so the vertical movement to the right, which looks like rise to the hitter, but what a four-seamer does is instead of coming down like gravity, it comes in, it resists gravity more, which to the hitter staring up towards the pitcher is looks like it's rising.
Yeah.
So more carry, more rise on the fastball. I think when, if you look it up on StatCast search, there was an extra inch of vertical movement on Gallen's fastball if you ignore the effect of gravity, as well as the velocity being up by about half a mile an hour compared to his first.
Well, I mean, he's not, Zach Gallen's not the hardest throwing pitcher out there. He needs a lot. He needs to have like a lot of movement on his pitch, like any pitcher does these days. You don't have the only way you can really succeed at the major league level, not throwing, you know, like, yeah, if you throw 100 miles per hour plus, yeah, you probably get by on a, you know, fastball, slider, or like, you know, the very basics. But when you throw 90, 92, or like 92, 94, you need to have that movement on your pitch. Like, yeah, his pitches looked a lot less, he looked, like I said, they looked livelier, which is, that's what I mean by it. He had a lot more movement on his pitches in game, in his second start versus his first start.
Yeah, I would argue even if you throw 100, you still need the right movement profile. Of course, you talked about a pitcher that has velocity and right movement profile. The D-backs ran into that guy in game one of the series, and they he shut him down basically for 5 2/3. And no, 4 2/3.
You actually called that in our last podcast episode or video that we did together, and I'll point that out. It's like that's all the reason to like, subscribe, leave a comment about how awesome is Michael's at predicting things with the Diamondbacks. He's one of the most knowledgeable writers out there, and you should definitely give him a follow on Twitter and read his articles on Inside the Diamondbacks, because he's very, I mean, honestly, you have a lot of knowledge about that, and you definitely call that one.
Yeah, I was gonna say, that's, if you're looking for that one, that's the audio only episode 49, which you can listen to also on Apple, Google, or Spotify. Give us a 5-star review if you're there. Anyway, so they got shut down by him, and then Ryan Nelson gave up 5 runs early, and it kind of felt like the D-backs were in that game. I guess I'm trying to find the right word. They were basically uphill the rest of the way, and they just didn't have enough stamina to go up the hill.
I mean, here's the thing is that the Yankees, I mean, you also actually predicted how the outcome of this series too. So credit to you for that one. It was an uphill battle in game one. Game two, it looked like the team
that cruised in game two.
Yeah, it's a team that we really, we believe in. And I think they're closer to that team than they are in game one. And I think that in today's game, Wednesday's game, they were game three of the Yankee series. They were cruising basically until towards the end of the game. I think one of the factors here is not having Paul Sewald, having your bullpen at full health, having really the rotation at full health too. Because I mean, we'll get into that, but like right now, you have Tommy Henry and Ryan Nelson are not looking good.
I mean, the main issue in that series was a couple of bad pitches and maybe one bad decision to pitch to a certain guy. I shouldn't say a certain guy. Pitched the Judge with an open base down a run.
Yeah.
That decision, we'll talk about that too. Actually, we'll talk about it now. That extra tack on run the Judge drove in the 11th inning ended up being the difference in the game. And and we could talk about whether or not the D-backs forcibly bat a relief pitcher with a game with a game on the line in a rubber game of a series, and how that's already bad on its own right. But there was about 6 different reasons, things that we can talk about that make a lot more sense if we're trying to, I guess you can say, critique the process more so than the results, which is what we want to do here. We don't focus on results. We focus on process and decision making, because that's where the criticism lies.
That's what I mean. Like the last half of that game, It just the way Torrey managed in extra innings is I did not like it. I actually turned off the TV when it went into extra innings because I knew how it was going to go. They were going to lose it. I did.
You turned off the TV after Aaron Judge hit that home run.
Yeah, no, I turned it back on, and then once it went back to extra inning, I turned it off like when they went down the first time, and they came back and tied it, went ahead, and okay, I'm like, okay, I'll turn it back on, and then I turned it back off when it went to extra innings, because here's the thing, the Diamondbacks have just like really not done well in extra innings with the automatic runner. I don't know how, as far as, like, there's definitely, I think it gives a disadvantage to the home team.
I don't necessarily think so. Because for the home, here's the thing.
It's a weird thing. It's weird, here's but I know I read something on FanGraphs that said that.
I mean, because here's the thing. If you're the home team, you're actually favored if it go. I feel like the home team should be favored when it goes 10. When it goes beyond the 10th thing, I think then the home team might be in trouble. Because the home team in the 10th thing is going to pitch their closer.
Yeah, I think
if he hasn't blown the save. Now, if your closer blows the save in extra innings, you're already screwed, but.
Yeah,
if you haven't burned in the Diamondbacks case where they already had their closer available and pitched him in the 10th inning and Ginkle threw a first pitch fastball and got hammered, but they overcame that.
Having McGuff have to hit was embarrassing.
Well, let's set that up first. So
that deserves mention in itself. That the fact that he had it.
And yes, I was arguing this on Twitter, and I am going to argue this on the podcast too. And as I said before, we're not going to critique the results. We're going to get into the process here. So we look at, okay, the Diamondbacks had a full bench after 9 innings. How did they end? Yeah. How did they get to a situation where they were forced to bat a pitcher in the 11th? So what happened in the 10th inning is they sent up Jace Peterson to bat for Blaze Alexander. And obviously that's probably the first decision, but we talked,
even get first, there, we should mention the Perdomo came up with a hamstring injury, or he like left the game with an injury. But that's how we got there in the first place. But so there you go. Continue where you were.
So extra innings. So you have the Manfred man on base already. So Jace Peterson bats for Blaze Alexander, and of course, if you look at Alexander's career so far, all four of his starts have come against left-hand pitching, and 11. Actually, let me check his plate appearances, but I think it was 11 of his first 14 plate appearances were against left-hand pitching. So I'm going to pull up his.
He's done quite well against,
Okay, like, so Alexander well, had three plate appearances.
Yeah.
Three plate appearances, a home run against Rodon. We're done in the first at bat. I think second at bat made an out. Third at bat drew a critical walk, which put the D-backs in, which knocked out Rodon, by the way. And then, of course, Jorge Barroso hits a piss missile right at Gleyber Torres, and D-backs don't put up any offense the final three innings of regulation afterwards. But so that's what started. So for what it looks to me, it's like Blaze will start against lefties, but I don't think they're necessarily convinced he'll hit right-hand pitching in the majors. Although at this point, I think you start looking into that and see how he does.
Oh yeah, at the very least he's a solid platoon bat. I think he's shown that so far.
You don't want to necessarily write him off as a platoon guy until he's actually proven it. And I think especially for a right-hand hitter. But they're obviously putting him in situation. They're putting him in favorable situations, which is why the number looks good. And they're putting him in favorable situations, and he's actually doing the job, which is a good sign. But now they're going to start putting, with the Perdomo injury, they're going to start putting him in more situations where he's going to see right-handed pitching, and he's going to see sliders down and away. So we'll see how he adjusts to that once they start doing that. So then they go into the it's the 9th inning, I think, they hit for play. So in the 10th inning, with the Manfred man on, they have Jock Peterson, or as I like to call him, Walk Peterson, hit for Tucker Barnhart. So then by hitting for the catcher, and you're trying to win the game in the 10th inning, obviously, and Peterson was your best option off the bench to basically either drive in one, maybe even two runs in that situation, which didn't happen, but D-backs eventually tied the game in the 10th inning on a Corbin Carroll chopper. So then, so now they had to burn Gabby. So you've now used three of your five bench players. Three of your four. You've used three of your four bench players at this point. So all you have left is McCarthy.
Yeah.
And then McCarthy has to come in the game because Perdomo gets hurt rounding first base, and it's looking like a right knee injury. His spring training injury was a left knee injury. I don't know how long Perdomo's going to be out. Nobody really does.
Too soon. We don't know yet.
Yeah.
It's tricky.
So it's right knee. And who knows if there's a sprain or if it's just soreness. But if there's a sprain, there's also the possibility of an IL stint. And we can talk about that next. But the main thing is they were down to the last position in the layer, and they had to burn him because they had an injury and McCarthy's got to come on the field.
Yeah.
And McCarthy did eventually come around to score that inning.
Yeah.
And run that inning.
It's unfortunate. That's how they kind of got. They got there. I mean, It went longer than you would have liked. I mean, a lot of things went wrong in the second half of that game. But really, it's like at the seventh inning onwards, I did not like the baseball I was seeing.
Yeah, really, since LeBros is batting, you can't really blame him for hitting into a double play. He had an absolute rocket that if it was feet the other way, the D-backs take a 3-2 lead, and maybe they win.
I mean, he showed some really fast, like, the speed on this, like, nearly, like, I mean, he was, like, maybe a half a step, you know, out, but I was still impressed by how fast he was, like, just in general. Like, I haven't really seen him run out. I haven't seen him run out a play yet, so... I was impressed by that.
So yeah, there's a one play in the game where Steve Berthune's getting ready to talk about Anthony Volpe getting another hit, and then out of nowhere, here comes Jorge Barroso to make a running catch. Ball had an XBA of 750, so 75 out of 100 times that ball is a hit. Basically,
he's had a good reputation as a good defensive outfielder. I mean, like, some of it was just bad luck in game three. I think the Shane Merrill Kelly had a good start.
I think Rodon matched him pitch for pitch until that sixth inning where the D-backs put some traffic on. Plus, if you also look in the 11th inning, they had, I think the shadows played a role into this to some degree. They had first, second, absolutely, nobody out. They didn't get hit a ball. It took him three batters to hit a ball. And Barroso ended up hitting a single in a situation where Barroso basically needed to hit a home run or the D-backs were going to lose.
Yeah, it's unfortunate.
I mean, Barroso does his job in that situation, but you're kind of screwed. You didn't tie the game. And now Aaron Boone realizes what's going on. So he's going to walk Moreno, even if that puts the tying run at third. And now basically your only chance of coming back in the game is a wild pitch. Or Scott McGuff doing something so incredible he'll have to buy a beer in Phoenix until the All-Star break, kind of thing.
You know, if there wasn't an injury, Jake McCarthy would be probably the batter in that scenario.
Yeah. I mean, the only other option they could have had was take Gurriel off the field, but in next inning game, do you really want to take your third or your fourth best hitter off the field, out of the lineup?
No.
Especially when it could have been a situation to drive in runs the next inning if you survived.
Yeah, no, it's understandable. 11th. Like, I mean, I get it. It's just, like, in terms of watching it, so I said, like, it was a great baseball to watch.
It's bad. It's a bad look to be forced to throw a reliever. I mean, who are you going to spat in that situation? They're not going to send Gallen out there. His arm's too valuable. They're not going to send Merrill Kelly out there. They can't send Merrill Kelly out in that situation. Who are they going to send out? Nelson?
And Trey Jameson's on the DL, unfortunately.
Well, I don't know if Trey Jameson can actually hit, but...
He might be able to run out at a hit, a chop bunt.
Outside of Gallen and Kelly, the guy who actually had the most recent plate appearance of any kind was McGuff, actually, believe it or not.
Yeah, that makes sense because isn't there a league that doesn't use the DH in Korea? He's pitching
No, he wasn't pitching the KBO. He was pitching in Japan, but that's basically how it comes down to in that situation.
Yeah. So there is one though. I know that. So if he was pitching in Japan, then yeah, he would have had at bats. I mean, yeah, you're not going to bat Merrill Kelly there. I mean, really.
Well, Kelly's out of the game. You can't bat him in that situation.
Yeah, you couldn't in that situation anyway. So I mean, either way, I guess you just you hope for the best with McGuff, and obviously, like we saw, that turned out. Perdomo's injury, I mean, obviously, we're not going to know anything until probably Friday.
No, we won't know until the Dimex play another game and Torrey's got to talk to the media. Yeah. But yeah, it's so he listed him as so after the game, he said day to day with Perdomo, which doesn't really mean anything.
Doesn't mean anything.
So we just got to wait. I would keep an eye on Kevin Newman, obviously. If he's out of the lineup in Reno, and Reno's basically in a situation where he's got to play shortstop every day, they don't really have infield depth because Lawler's out with a recovering from right thumb surgery. If Newman's not on the Reno roster, that should be a pretty obvious tell. Although they don't necessarily.
If they DFA or trade someone immediately to make room for Kevin Newman, that's a pretty obvious tell, too.
I mean, I don't know what they're going to do necessarily. There isn't any clear-cut DFA candidate. And before anyone says Paven Smith, it's like the Diamondbacks don't necessarily. If they DFA Smith, then they don't really have a realistic first base option outside of Walker.
Walston.
They're not going to give up on a 22-year-old pitching prospect in AAA.
Yeah, I don't really see an option.
Even if I don't think he's going to pan out.
Who is the least painful option?
Yeah, they're not going to give up on a 22-year-old pitching prospect because Walston could end up going to the International League and putting up good numbers.
Yeah, that's true. He would do a lot better. I mean, I'm pretty sure any team's going to pick him up off the.
By the way, if Walston were to get DFA'd, he would just get somebody would probably trade for him.
I think they would just trade him off the roster. Maybe. I'm
sure. One other option would be you would activate Grichuk off the IL and trade McCarthy.
Yeah, that is an option. I could see them doing that, actually. They've been trying to move him. I've offered him a trade. So I like Jake McCarthy. I think, I don't know if he'll ever reach his ceiling, if he's already reached his ceiling.
I could see him reaching a ceiling somewhere else.
Yeah, I think that's the thing. I could see him reaching a ceiling somewhere else in a different organization. I think maybe a change of scenery actually might do him really well. It'll make me sad seeing him, do well with like the Marlins or the Yankees or LA, God forbid.
Why the Yankees? They have no room for him.
I'm just throwing out any team that, whether it's Marlins or the Yankees or the Dodgers would be the worst possible team for him to succeed with, but
the D-backs aren't trading McCarthy. Yeah, the D-backs aren't trading McCarthy in the division.
Yeah, I don't see them releasing or DFAing. They just trade him.
Well, if McCarthy gets DFA'd, he would get traded. I mean, heck, Rivera got traded.
Yeah, that's they both got. Yeah, interesting enough, like both Strzelecki and Rivera, most recent DFAs got just for cash. So that's always a possibility. I could see them doing that. Especially.
Well, it's just like. Well, actually, no, that applies to McCarthy too. Never mind.
Yeah, it would be the same thing. So.
No, I think McCarthy would get more than cash back.
I think you could at least get a lottery ticket for him.
Nah, a little bit better than that. I think you get a double A guy.
A fungible reliever. As they say.
I mean, heck, Dominic Fletcher got a legit pitching prospect back.
That's where I'm saying, like, I think you should be able to get something for him. That's the return I'd like to see him. I don't know if he'll get that because that was the choice was Fletcher or McCarthy. And they're like, oh, we'll take Fletcher. So.
I mean, the one downside to McCarthy, he's got Fletcher's has 6 years of control and two options, whereas McCarthy had 5 years of control with one of them being as a super two player and one option left.
So, yeah, he probably gets like a double A or a lottery ticket, I would think. Or maybe, kind of equivalent level change of scenery guy that's not on the 40 man.
All right. And then let's get to the third and final topic. One turn through the rotation, and Tommy Henry's going to start again game one against the Braves. The D-backs only got 4-plus from Henry, gave up 5 runs against the Rockies. No, yeah, 4 or 5 runs against the Rockies, and then Ryan Nelson's start was an absolute disaster. 2 2/3, where he basically sucked from pitch one and gave up 5 runs, and his final pitch being a part of a snowball fight.
Yeah, I was just going to say they sucked. Like, Tommy Henry and Ryan Nelson sucked. How about that? I'm not too thrilled with seeing either. I'm really looking forward to Jordan Montgomery, or I'm not sure who's going to be there first.
So we know Montgomery is targeting an April 19th return. There's actually a clause in his contract that says he has to be in the major leagues by then.
Yeah.
So D-backs are going to pitch him on April 7th, then the 13th, and then he'll make his team debut in San Francisco on the 19th.
Yeah, so this will, as of when this comes out, it'll be the 4th, so it's like 2 weeks away. So you're going to have to go two turns through the rotation at least. Tomorrow's an off day, thankfully, which helps.
Yeah, you're going to see two more starts out of Henry and Nelson for sure. And then I think Eduardo Rodriguez is going to be, we'll find out by the end of the Braves series, obviously. Somebody, either Nick Pecora or Steve Gilbert's going to report this, but the Eduardo Rodriguez is trending towards throwing a bullpen soon.
I would think that he would be back before Monty if he's not having any
kind of... No, he's going to come back right after.
Or right afterwards.
Both should be back by the end of the month, but...
Yeah.
I don't know about two turns to the rotation.
I think that in fact, it's the cold weather and just like overall and all. I don't know if Reno's at home or where they're playing. Are rehabbing in AAA right now. Like, most AAA West cities have been pretty chilly, and they're all outdoor stadiums. So I worry about the rehab going a little slower than normal, and it actually kind of makes sense they're taking their time with both.
I mean, Montgomery's healthy. It's just a matter of ramping him up.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we're not going to ramp him up, you know, super quick in cold weather. That's the thing. So, Henry and Nelson, I think Nelson he was just bad. Just wasn't pitching good. Like, I don't even know where to start on that. And Henry,
I mean, it's just one start for both of them. You got to see improvement next time out. And I don't know if Henry's necessarily going to, of course, both of them are going to be in a trial by fire. They're going to be playing the Braves lineup in the upcoming series against Atlanta.
Well, it's going to be like a cage match, because it's like, you know, after this, those two turns in the rotation, one of them has to go. So, I mean, hopefully that's motivation enough for them. They click, or is this a bad start? A bad start.
Yeah. Torrey Lovell downplayed the notion of the impending return of Erod plus Montgomery's team debut, putting in extra pressure, obviously just fighting. They're fighting for a spot in the major leagues anyway, to begin with. They could be one really bad start away from getting replaced by Slade Ciccone, of all people.
That's always an option too. I don't think he's any worse of an option necessarily than either one.
So, yeah, Slade's made two starts in Reno. First one, 5 no-hit innings. Second start, got hit around a little bit, 6 runs and 4+ against Sacramento.
Yeah, at Sacramento?
No, it was in Reno. So,
okay.
The strikeout to walk ratio was fairly good. I don't think he gave up any homers. I'll have to double check. And the 6th run came after he left the ballgame.
It's not like either one of them has had better results necessarily. Only one of our recent minor league prospects that said been done good in Reno, where it's like better than that, is Brandon Fott. And he's like, we're not all that worried about him.
I mean, the thing about Fott is Fott, you feel like you can trust to go 9 innings every time out. I mean, not 5 innings. Did I say 5? Did I say 9? I meant 5.
You said 9. Yeah, he's definitely...
Okay, so they give up 2 homers.
Okay, that's... do you have the wind direction on that game? like how fast the wind was blowing, because if it was blowing out, that could contribute to the home run. You always gotta check. That's actually one of the reasons to check your weather and your box scores, people listening, is that
okay, eight miles an hour wind, left to right.
Yeah, okay, you 8 miles per hour left to right. Those might have been a little bit of a wind blown home run. Yeah, that's why you check your box scores, because some of these ballparks are really windy, and like you know, what we normally be a fly out in a major league ballpark, it's blown into a home run.
Yeah, I'm gonna check the numbers. Also, day games, so the ball's gonna carry a little bit more.
Yeah.
So, let's see, exit velocity against Ciccone, Luis Matos, 103 and
29. Okay, that's legit.
And the other home run against Ciccone was 96 and 31, which, unless it's hit down,
okay,
it would have to be hit down the line in most ballparks.
That sounds like it might have been a little wind assisted one.
All right. So we can look up the play. Okay, so right field. So 96 and 21 to right, 31 to right field. Maybe that's probably an out at the major league level.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I trust. I mean, that's not giving up a home run, and you know, that's not that bad of a start. Not the best, but you know, average the two, super small sample size. That's not bad results so far for Slade and Reno.
I mean, that's basically how it comes down to.
You know, I like I said, I trust him just as much as I trust Tommy Henry or Ryan Nelson.
I mean, basically, none of these guys you can count on to give you five innings night in, night out, and that's kind of the concern.
Yeah.
Especially when the bullpen is a little shorthanded.
Yeah, it seems very apparent why they rushed out to sign Jordan Montgomery now.
So, like I said, both Henry and Nelson will have two starts to prove themselves. Like I said, one will definitely be removed out of the rotation once Montgomery comes back. And based on what I have, assuming nobody gets skipped, Nelson actually pitches on the 18th. So I think he's actually in more trouble than Henry, but I could be wrong. Yep.
Probably. If he's, I mean, whoever's like, it lines up better, I think by default, unless they're like, just like have two fantastic starts, they're more likely to get taken out of the rotation. That makes a lot of sense. You know, I was gonna say, what's the Diamondbacks record? 500.
Their record. 500? They're 4-3 going into the Braves series.
Okay, so they're game above 500, and really, I think as long as they can get,
as long as they're not five games under 500, but even then, you can overcome that.
They can overcome that. I mean, I think if they can get both, you know, Erod and Montgomery in the rotation, and then eventually Seawald, and they're at least 500, a game or two under, that's okay. I mean, that's not ideal, but if they're very, very least 500 or above, that's solid. That's solid to me. I think they're in a good position at that point. If they you know, are losing or getting swept every series, then I'm going to get, like, if they get swept by the Braves, I'm going to be concerned.
Yeah, the pitching matchup does not favor the Diamondbacks in any of the three games, assuming Strider pitches game one.
It does not matter. It is not. Facing that lineup, it doesn't look good.
Yeah, and the track record of two of the three starters, but I do think if they have, like, anything more than four losses on this road trip, and that's a very concerning thing to me. Because at least if you get swept by the Braves, you can salvage a series. You got to salvage a series win against the Rockies, of course.
Yeah, that's
not easy to do.
Not easy to do. That's the despite point.
Even when the Rockies least, suck,
they're gonna
it's hard to take least, a series.
At least one against the Braves. And I think that's a good way to second into the part two.
So now we're into part two of the of episode 50 of the Snakes on Diamond podcast. Joining me today to talk about the Atlanta Braves series is Braves Today managing editor Lindsey Crosby, and Braves Today being also part of the Fan Nation Network with Inside the Diamondbacks. So, how are you doing today, Lindsey?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
So, to give our readers a little bit of context, do you want to kind of just give a little bit of information on your background into baseball writing?
Yeah, so I've been running BravesToday.com since we started 2 years ago. This is our second season, fully credentialed beat writer. I'll actually be in the ballpark on Friday and Saturday for this series. Before this, I was the host producer of the Locked On MLB Prospects podcast, actually won the IBWAA 2023 Prospect Writer of the Year Award for my work over there. We just wrapped that up right before spring training this year. So 2 years there, now on my second year with Braves Today. And then we just launched InsideTheMarlins.com for SI, covering the Miami Marlins and what's been a pretty disastrous start for the Marlins. So it's been fun to see the two extremes of Braves and Marlins, right?
Yeah. I'll have to bring you on for that, for those series.
Yeah.
All right. So first question, obviously, the main topic is going to be the lopsided pitching matchup in game one. I wanted to ask you about Spencer Strider, who has apparently added a third plus pitch to his arsenal and looks like the favorite to win the National League Cy Young this year as a result. So can you kind of just tell everyone how that pitch came about and how it's been going so far?
Yeah, so I had a chance to talk to Spencer Strider in Northport during spring training, and he kind of broke down the issue with the changeup. That was his third pitch. His bread and butter has been the fastball slider combo, and they're both plus-plus pitches. The issue he had with the changeup was more biomechanical. He had done as much as he could to improve the changeup with the way that his motor preferences work, the way that that he holds the ball. He's middle finger dominant. You know, he's a supinator. And so just the specific stuff about how he throws baseballs biomechanically, he couldn't really get the changeup any better than what it was. And so it maxed out about 6, 7% of usage. And it really was just, if a team was like, or a individual batter was, say, sitting slider and they were just fouling off all the fastballs, it gave him a velocity change that he could use throwing the changeup. And he wanted something that could both give more movement than what the slider did and be significantly slower. He looked at other options. He looked at maybe a two-seam fastball to get more of that arm side run. And what he ultimately came down to was the curveball because he has that middle finger dominance. And the big concern when we saw it early in spring was, it's going to be a handedness thing, right? He's only going to use it in certain situations against certain batters, like, you know, against lefties, try to, you know, backfoot it to lefties and things like that. He's been able to use it both against righties and lefties and has a lot of confidence that what it's going to allow him to do is sequence just enough to punish a hitter who sits slider and fouls off the fastball. That was the game plan the Phillies had against him in the NLDS last year, is they just sat slider, they were looking for that, and they would just foul off a fastball until they got a slider to hit. And so now, facing Philly on opening day, or I guess on Friday, you could see situations where they were looking for the slider, he could drop a curveball under their bat, get a weak ground ball, or get a swing and miss. And that's really what he's using it for. But for a guy who led the league in strikeouts last year with essentially just two pitches, adding a third plus-plus pitch is a little bit absurd and a situation where Braves fans feel like he's definitely the favorite for the Cy Young for a reason.
So also going into that game, the Diamondbacks will be throwing in left-hander Tommy Henry. Back in spring training, Torey Lovello mentioned the Braves as a lefty killing lineup. Do you want to go into detail about that?
Yeah, it's the Braves don't platoon a lot, right? They have almost like eight players play almost every single day. Well, I guess seven because your catcher and your left fielder. But they're so good up and down the lineup against lefty starters that a lot of teams last year just changed the rotation so that they didn't have to send lefties against Atlanta. The Braves faced a league low 32 left-handed starters last year. And there's a reason for that. Because in those 32 games, they batted 290 with an 870 OPS, and they hit 60 homers in those 32 starts. So it's something where a ton of their guys don't really have platoon splits. Matt Olson's a little bit worse against lefties, right? You know, a couple guys here and there, but they have hitters who do really well against lefties and are good enough against righties to stay in. Michael Harris II is a guy who batted almost 300 last year, but batted over 300 against lefties. So there's enough depth in the lineup where most of your guys can play every day because they can hit lefties. And then you do have Adam Duvall is going to rotate in for Jared Kelnick, because while Duvall doesn't have a significant lefty-righty platoon split against lefty starters, he batted 280 last year. So something where you'll see Atlanta with a specific lineup just to face the starter, and then when he comes out of the game, you'll probably see Jared Kelnick rotate in left field, but they're comfortable all of their guys can hit lefties well enough for them to win this game.
Yeah, and you look at Tommy Henry, he was on the outside looking in for a rotation spot in the Eduardo Rodriguez injury situation. I was actually at that game when it happened. Mm-hmm. So Rodriguez suffers a lat strain pitching against Chicago. Then he's currently on the IL, but he's slated to throw a bullpen pretty soon. So then Henry, in his next two starts, ended up throwing 9 1/3 scoreless, ended up winning the rotation job, and actually looked good for about 5.5 hitters into his season, but then the wheels kind of just fell off from there, and he got bit by the big inning against Colorado.
Yeah, it when I watch Tommy Henry, it feels like it's a couple of things. And one, he is vulnerable against lefty hitters. I think his batting average allowed in his career is like almost 300 against lefty hitters. But it feels like some of it's an execution issue, that he just he's not as crisp into the start as he needs to be. And the worry I have for Arizona here is Atlanta is very, very good about scoring early. Ronald Acuna Jr., Ozzie Albies, Matt Olson, or Austin Riley, Matt Olson's your top four. And in so many games last year, they, by the end of the first inning, they would be up 2-0, 3-0. And I'm really worried that like his strength, which is starting off strong, is going to be negated by this Atlanta lineup. That's my worry there, because they can give him two or three lefties to face in the first inning, and they can get runs on you in a hurry.
Yeah, that's definitely Diamondbacks fans are familiar with. The Diamondbacks have scored 2+ runs in the first inning in 5 of their 7 games so far this year. Now, granted, 4 of them were against Colorado, but
Colorado's still a major league team for now. Yeah. So it still counts. It still counts.
All right, so I figured I'd open the floor for you to ask any questions while I try to think of another one.
Yeah, and I think a couple questions for Braves fans, and I was kind of talking to some of our readers about what they wanted to know. I think one of the biggest questions from the outside, it doesn't look like Corbin Carroll is having the type of start to his year that you would expect from Corbin Carroll. Is this just maybe some bad luck early? Is this a health thing? What's going on with Corbin Carroll?
A lot of the issue with Corbin Carroll, it starts with quality of contact, and I think he's kind of stuck between swings, because last year he had about 3 separate injury scares with his right shoulder, the same shoulder that was surgically repaired 3 seasons ago.
Yeah. Can we real quick acknowledge how weird it is that 3 straight first round picks had shoulder injuries almost immediately after signing with the Diamondbacks? Like, what is going on with that? That was weird.
Yeah, that's weird. If you want to include McClain, they've had 4 first round picks that have needed shoulder surgery, although in McClain's case, that's 6 years after the fact.
Yeah, but like, drafted. Like it was Carroll, then it was Lawler, then it was Drew Jones. And like, I think Drew Jones was the first day he was there taking batting practice after being drafted. It's like it was sooner and sooner every time. I feel like the next guy, whoever you draft in the first round this year, is going to trip and fall at the draft and hurt his shoulder and need shoulder surgery is what it feels like.
Yeah, I was going to say Lawler suffered a UCL injury in his right thumb picking up a baseball right before the season was going to start for Reno.
What a bad break, too.
And that injury is hurting them right now, because Perdomo left yesterday's game with a right knee injury. So they're kind of have to figure out a shortstop, they're kind of down to Blaze Alexander as the only healthy shortstop on the 40-man roster right now.
Which is tough. I mean, and I guess there's another question from Atlanta fans, too, about the outfield defense, right? Alec Thomas on the IL. Like we said, Corbin Carroll still super speedy, doesn't look the same, but I think his defense is okay. Lourdes Gurriel in left. I'm assuming it's kind of, it's mostly Jorge Barroso or Jake McCarthy rotating in. Is the outfield defense still going to be good enough when you get into a ballpark like Atlanta's ballpark that tends to play up for hitters a bit? Is it going to be good enough to keep these runs off the board?
Yeah, if you look at the Diamondbacks outfield defense, with Thomas out, their best outfield defender is Barroso, and he'll definitely get starts against Fried and the left-hand throwing Fried and Sale since he's a switch hitter. And McCarthy is a left-hand hitter. So I imagine Barroso will definitely get the start against Sale, who's basically a death to left-hand hitters because that ball is basically coming from behind their heads.
It is an incredibly uncomfortable at-bat for lefties because he's so horizontal with everything that he does. And the good thing, I've had some questions about this recently. The good thing is, I guess for Atlanta fans, not for Diamondbacks fans, is a lot of Sale's pitch movement is back to what, maybe not vintage Chris Sale, White Sox Chris Sale, but not the reduced movement and velocity we saw last year. It's back to 2018, 2019 numbers on the slider, the amount of break on the slider, the fastball velocity and induced vertical break on that. And so it's not runner-up to the Cy Young Chris Sale, but it's 2018 World Series winning Chris Sale is the stuff that's here and his health. And so Braves fans are pretty high on his ability to hold his own against a lineup like this, especially one that has had struggles in the past with some lefties.
And the Diamondbacks have done a lot of work to try and fix their lineup against lefties. The addition of Gurriel was huge last year against lefties. He hit 321 last year. And Christian Walker, Ketel Marte are guys that can put a charge in the ball against left-hand pitching. Although Marte's home run rate was a little bit down against left-hand pitching last year. Although Carlos Rodon certainly doesn't agree with that.
Eugenio Suarez feels like last year was better against lefties, had a terrible strikeout rate, but it improved against lefties versus righties. I think the only kind of question I have is I think he only got 3 home runs against lefties last year. So it's more of a contact versus homer profile with Suarez in there. And you have to hope the strikeouts don't offset what he can do offensively. But I feel like the teams match up well, but it's hard to see from this side, at least. It's hard to see where Atlanta maybe gives an advantage to Arizona in any respect as far as defense, as far as pitching, offense. Kind of feels like it's a little bit lopsided, and some of that's because of Carroll's injury, Thomas's injury, things like that. Feels like the Braves should have the advantage in pretty much the series here.
Yeah, it's going to come. I think it comes down to starting pitching, the Diamondbacks execution on starting pitching, because it's the Braves top three against the Diamondbacks bottom three in the rotation.
And that's a bad break for Atlanta with Gallen and Kelly going the last 2 weeks. I was high on Brandon Pfaadt just back doing the prospect podcast, really high on what he could have done last year. We saw it late. Obviously he had a terrible start to the year, those first 6 starts, but I feel like he probably has the best chance of the three of keeping Arizona in it. The question's going to be kind of like you said, can the rest of the pitching staff keep Atlanta off the board long enough? We've seen games this year where Atlanta's dealing with really good velocity. They've not necessarily been able to get the offense that they expected, and they had to make it happen against the bullpen. If Atlanta gets into the Diamondbacks bullpen, how confident are you in, I guess, you know, some of your guys, your Joe Manaplea, things like that, of being able to keep Atlanta off the board in a close game late?
Yeah, because I think since Atlanta is very, I guess you can say, slightly leans right-handed lineup, you're going to see guys like Ryan Thompson and Miguel Castro and Luis Frias kind of take over kind of the middle innings, and Thompson's going to be their primary setup guy. Whereas, is there a spot in their lineup where you might see 2 or 3 lefties? Although I think that's not going to be the case.
Atlanta's pretty good about spreading it out. At worst, they'll have back-to-back righties at the bottom, like 7 and 8. But for the most part, they almost never stack the lefties together. It's always right, left, going all the way down to the very bottom. So you don't really have a chance to face more than one lefty unless it's the first and third batters for the outing, and the second's going to be a righty in the middle. They're pretty good about that. And then, like I said, they don't really pinch hit a lot other than whichever left fielder's not in the game coming in. They don't really do a lot of pinch hitting stuff. And it's just, these are our guys, beat them or don't beat them. That's always the question there.
Yeah, because I don't see really much of a situation where D-backs can slot in Joe Mantiply or Kyle Nelson based on the lineup.
Which I feel like helps Atlanta, that you can kind of eliminate them somewhat based on matchups and based on the configuration of the lineup. I feel like because they're some of the better relievers, helps out Atlanta a little bit.
Yeah, so the main news with the Diamondbacks bullpen is Seawald's going to be out until at least mid-May with a low-grade 2 oblique strain. So now kind of everyone's kind of slid down. And then Ginkle's been the ninth inning guy for D-backs so far this year, taking on the closer role. And Thompson's been solid so far this year, 2 scoreless outings. Going from the 7th to the 8th inning, it's just the main... If the Atlanta gets the Diamondbacks bullpen, let's say, before the 7th, before the 6th inning, the Diamondbacks are in a lot of trouble.
Yeah, and
for that game.
I feel like that's something we've seen Atlanta be able to do last year a ton. This year, it's somewhat mixed results, but I feel like they have the potential, especially against the bottom three of a rotation. Atlanta has the potential to put up multiple runs in a hurry and get you into your bullpen. The only thing that I worry about with Atlanta is sometimes they get very aggressive in at-bats. And so if you can execute pitches the first and second pitch of an at-bat and can get them to fly out to ground out, whatever it might be, you can keep a pitch count pretty low. But the issue is going to be if you make a mistake, they will crush it. And it feels like it's not going to be as so much pitch count as it's going to be how many mistakes do you make that get crushed before you just got to come out of the game and they got to put somebody who can minimize the mistakes. That's the big thing for Atlanta is if you make a mistake, they're going to get it. They preach hitting balls in the strike zone hard. And so they're very aggressive in the zone, very aggressive early in the count. Question's going to be, if you're going to miss, don't miss middle. And that's easier said than done, especially for young pitchers sometimes.
Yeah, and the main issue with Henry and Nelson are both consistent pitch making. Mm-hmm. Like in the case of Henry, obviously, when he was going well against the Rockies, he was hitting the corners, spotting it up, and then he made some mistakes with secondary stuff, and he got hammered as a result with it. In Nelson's case, I know the numbers say differently. I know he was strike one on 12 of 17, but then Nelson was in hitters counts and really didn't have any command of his stuff, and he was missing out of the zone. So basically put himself in a pretty bad position against the Yankees, and it ended up resulting in a lot of long innings. And one play in particular, they had a double error where a throw from Gurriel missed everyone. And then Nelson, trying to get a runner advancing from second to third, ends up airmailing the third baseman. And that guy came around to score.
That's tough. Yeah. That's not good. Atlanta's a team that has gotten better at base running. The team's speed isn't necessarily great. You've got, you know, Ronald Acuña Jr. obviously is fast. Jared Kelnick is fast. None of them are Corbin Carroll fast. They're all decent runners. But overall, team speed isn't necessarily that great. It's below average. But they've gotten better at knowing when to run, going first to third, taking advantage of mistakes and things like that. And so the game plan to keep Atlanta's offense off the board or minimize their production is don't make mistakes at the plate and don't make mistakes on defense, because they'll take an extra base. They're willing to sacrifice to move a guy. They don't bunt a ton, but they'll sacrifice to move a guy. They'll take an extra base. They'll do a hit and run, things like that. So that's going to be the question here, is how clean, I guess, can the Diamondbacks play from top to bottom? Because they are on the road, and we know that road teams oftentimes struggle, especially teams from out west coming east and coming forward in time zones. So,
yeah, I feel like when the Diamondbacks win, they're very good at minimizing mistakes. You look at the Rocky series, clean games in all three of their wins. Their win against the Yankees pretty clean game across the board. So, and the games that they make mistakes defensively is usually when they get burned.
Yeah, and that's it almost feels like because Corbin Carroll's a little bit slow to start the year, Gabriel Moreno feels from the outside that he's a little bit slow to start the year. I think he's batting, like, when I looked this morning, under 220. It feels like because of that, the margin for error is a little bit slimmer. And so it's going to come down to execution. My ultimate prediction, I think, is Atlanta probably takes 2 out of 3. I think Arizona does pick one up. And these Arizona came into Atlanta last year and won some games in July. And so it's going to be a great battle. But I think the rotation kind of helps. And then Atlanta having a lot more lefties in their bullpen this year than they had last year, I think that also gives the Braves the ability to deploy their relievers a little more strategically versus just, here's our 7th inning guy, here's our 8th inning guy, here's our 9th inning guy. And I think that could end up being a factor late when you look at a Diamondbacks bullpen that's slotted into different roles than usual versus a Braves bullpen that has more depth than usual.
So, wanted to mention how's Max Fried doing?
Yeah, so it was a rough start against the Phillies. He 2/3 of an inning, threw, I think, 40-something pitches. He talked after the game that he was having trouble with grip and things like that because of the cold weather, and then just didn't really have his locations that well. He threw a side session. Everything looked fine. He said he's fine. The Braves aren't too concerned. One of the issues you had in that game was the inning was extended because of a middle pitch called a ball that ended up extending that by 3 more batters and in a couple runs. And so the thought for the Braves is he's going to be fine. There's nothing to worry about. And it was kind of a fluke in that first outing. Velocity wasn't 100% there, but he was also getting ramped up. It did increase throughout that first inning. He just threw a lot of pitches. They're not worried about it, but they do feel like they have the bullpen pieces to, especially with being off the last 2 days because of weather, that if he needs to have another abbreviated start, they can cover, but they don't think he will. They think he'll be fine.
All right, so anything else we want to discuss here?
I'm curious to get your prediction on the whole thing. Like I said, I think it's probably 2-1 Atlanta over Arizona, but I'm open to being convinced otherwise.
Yeah, I don't see very many pathways for the Diamondbacks to take 2 games. Obviously, sweeping a series with the talent level in both teams is pretty difficult.
Yeah,
but like I said, the starting pitching matchup favors Atlanta in all 3 games, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. I think the closest one is going to be Fried versus Fott, because obviously Fried's not as stretched out as the other starters, and then Brandon Fott's their best pitcher going into the series. That's one of those games, I think, where Fott can pitch close enough that maybe the Diamondbacks can get ahead against the Braves bullpen with maybe a well-timed hit. But that's pretty much why I have.
Yeah, that sounds pretty where I am kind of as well. So thanks for having me. All right.
And thank you for taking the time to listen in on the Snakes on the Diamond podcast. We're available on Apple, Google, Spotify, as well as Amazon Music, iHeartRadio, and TuneIn. So if you're listening on your favorite podcasting platform, make sure to give us a 5-star review and let us know what you think is going to happen in the Atlanta series.